No.
Excellent. Yeah, that's my name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic drug addict. I suffer with various degrees of mental illness, depending on, whatever, the time of day, how much sleep I had. Some days I just wake up with it. Other days, like today, I found myself humming the theme to Sesame Street. And that's always a sure sign I'm happy. So I must be happy today. I did. I got to see my great grandson today, so that always lightens me up. And I had an active day today, just on the move from the get-go. That's good for me. I have a tendency to be sedimentary, something like that, sedentary, maybe. Anyway, my sobriety date's January 10th, 1995. Was first exposed to AA as a teenager in 1986 or 1985. Yeah, August 16th was my original sobriety date, 1985. I lasted 22 months.
Frank, your fan is interfering with you. Can
Oh,
you?
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
That better? Okay, yeah. I know Marcella hates that, and I always turn it down for her. Yeah, I'm living in Tampa,
Sorry, I
Florida.
interrupt.
Well, that's all right. I'm living in Tampa, Florida right now in a RV camper. And I don't run the air conditioning on the generator just because it's really loud. And I have a dog. And as soon as he goes out the door to go outside, it lets all the heat in. So it seems kind of silly to air condition this camper to have the dog let all the heat back in a couple minutes. He has a hard time deciding where he wants to post up. Yeah, so I came in as a teenager. I was court ordered. Before that, from the get go, I believe I was an alcoholic and drug addict. I loved the effect of alcohol from the very start. And I never wanted to be sober ever again, anytime. I wanted to be under the influence of something. As a, like 12, 13-year-old kid, it was easier to get marijuana than drinking. I did do a lot of experimenting with household chemicals, gasoline, paint, rubber cement. I was a big fan of glue, often that. Just anything I could get my hands on to alter my state. I don't really remember much before like 11, 12, and I'm sure there's reasons for that. Nothing I've ever been able to put a finger on. But yeah, there's definitely trauma, a huge amount of neglect in my childhood. I didn't go to the dentist until I was like 12. And I paid the price my whole life for that. But it turned out, when I was like 25, 26, I found out the big family secret that the father that raised me wasn't my real dad. He was over in Vietnam and he came home to a pregnant wife. And my mother would never tell me who my real father was. It's not like it was a one night thing because he was around for a while. And she just refused to tell me. And I don't know what, why, or, she just never shared that with me. I'm sure she has a reason, but, now she's got dementia, alcoholic dementia. So, she doesn't remember last week. Yeah, so, I grew up with that big family secret. It's like all my siblings knew, but I didn't. And they treated me accordingly. I wasn't, one of them. I was, whatever. And, I lived with my father for a while, the father that raised me. And then I moved in with my mom when I was like 12. She had remarried some other dude and when they after they got divorced. And I don't know. Like my family of origin is really a mess. It's just a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs, a lot of criminal behavior, gambling, high speed driving, high speed motorcycle racing, a lot of illegal activity. And those were my role models, my older brothers. I have three older brothers and an older sister, and those are the guys I looked up to because I didn't really have a father figure, you know. Yeah, so, I always felt like, I was the new kid that I bounced around from school to school when, through the divorce and everything. I made the best of what I could. And once I discovered alcohol and drugs, man, I didn't care about anything else. And it did, it cut, it, I got in a lot of trouble. I could never control my intake. I liked having like a six beer buzz. I just like having like six beers in me and feeling good, and I could just never stay there. It was like by the time I got to that level, I already had like three more shots waiting to hit me, and all of a sudden I was drunk and, blacking out, and I thought that was normal. And it really didn't matter because it just came with the territory. I was willing to accept all that just to for the effects that I got and the feelings I got from it. It was a complete transformation. I was Jekyll and Hyde, for sure. I had to change. And actually, one of my friend's mothers told me I was an alcoholic when I was 15. We were over at his house partying, and she was down in the kitchen. We were up in his room in the attic. And I came downstairs, and she said, "You're an alcoholic, Frank." I go, "What?" She's like, "I was married to an asshole like you. And you've got the change. You are not the same kid that came in here a half hour." And she was right, but at that point, you could have called me anything you wanted. I wasn't listening to anybody, taking advice from anybody. I didn't really have any kind of respect for authority or anybody else. I thought everybody drank and did drugs, and if they didn't, they were missing out. I just had a really warped perception of life, and I was a very angry juvenile delinquent. And I got in a lot of trouble. And like I said, I was court ordered to AA. And I came in, and I had to go to seven meetings a week for a year. So I was at a meeting every night. I had to ride my bicycle there because they suspended my driver's license for my first DUI. And, but I sat in the back, got my slip signed, tried not to interfere with anybody. And then this Irish or English guy, Henry, was leading my home group, turned into my home group later. And he had gone in front of the judge I was waiting to go in front of. And here was a guy that could help. Here was somebody that I should talk to. Here was somebody that had experience with my judge and might be able to give me like the inside scoop on this guy. So I went up and talked to him after a meeting and after he led. And he turned me on to this other guy who was a secretary at that group. And he was like the golden child of AAA. He was a CPA. He had gotten in trouble early in high school and gotten sober and went to college, got a CPA, and just did everything right. So he became my sponsor. And I got hooked into AA. And I, when I first got a copy of the Big Book, I found myself in there. I related to everything in there. I knew that this had been my problem because I was very suicidal when I came in. Not because I was forced to come to AA, I was just ready to go. My life was just, I just couldn't handle my emotions. I went through this breakup and, I was homicidal and suicidal and just off the chains. And AA really saved me. And it gave me that hope that, maybe I'm not just a misfit or a bad kid. Maybe, this is my problem. Maybe I'm just an alcoholic and a drug addict. And so I did, I got sober. And it was really good for me. I went to lots of meetings and I really embraced it and really enjoyed it. And it was like a foreign world to me, coming from where I came from to have somebody, this guy Ernie, I'll never forget. Ernie was a Vietnam vet and he talked about sniffing glue from the podium. And back in the 80s, you didn't talk about drugs at AA meetings, with alcohol only, don't talk about drugs, especially not from the podium when you're speaking at a meeting. And I thought, man, this guy knows. Finally, I can relate to somebody. So I went up and talked to Ernie, and he became a really good friend of mine. But one night, prior to all that happening, I went up and shook his hand. It was like tradition to shake everybody's hand at the meetings back in, I got sober in Cleveland on the west side in Lorain County. And that was just, you just went around and shook everybody's hand, introduced yourself. That was just AA back then. That's what you did. And I shook Ernie's hand, and I was of course looking at the floor. And he said, "How you doing, Frank?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm fine." And I went to walk away, and he didn't let go of my hand. And I it just like broke my, my whole routine of skipping through meetings and not being noticed and not having to talk to anyone. And he's like, wouldn't let go of my hand. And I looked up at him, and I'm like, what? He's like, "No, Frank, really, how are you?" And it was like the first person I'd ever felt like that gave a shit about me. And it broke through everything. It just really transformed my life. Because I had never felt that kind of just unconditional caring. It's like he didn't expect anything from me. He's just concerned. He was like looking like a big brother or a father, looking after somebody, and he was looking out for me. And that's, been my AA experience, all these years. Yeah, so I lasted like 22 months the first time. I met a girl in AA. I could tell you where it was. I was at this barn meeting on Avon Tuesday, and she walked in and she had this golden light around her. And I was like, oh my God, who is this? And we got together, and then I got her pregnant, and I was 19 when my daughter was born. And I was living in my mom's basement, working 8 hours a week, going to AA meetings at night with some 40-year-old guys. We'd go out for coffee till 2 in the morning after the meeting. And there was a huge group of young people back then. I was just really lucky for the place I was back then. We had a lot of fun. We had picnics and a lot of AA. We had an AA softball team, just a bunch of really cool AA things going on there. And yeah, so I have my first nervous breakdown when I realize I'm going to be a father, and I'm going to have to change my whole life. And I start working 60 hours a week, and then I start getting stressed out, and I cut down on my meetings, and things are just getting really tight. And my brothers go to Indianapolis every year for the time trials at the Indy 500, and they meet my dad. He comes up from Oklahoma, the father that raised me. This was before I found out he wasn't my real dad. And I decided I'm going to go on this trip with these guys, and I'm going to party 1 weekend out of the year and just get rid of all that stress and get it all out of my system, and then come back and be sober. And I was high before we left the neighborhood. I was getting high in this gas station bathroom, and then we went down to Indy, and I got hammered, and the same stuff that always happened. And it was total chaos with the brothers, and wandering around drunk from the bars. And yeah, so I came back, and AA wasn't the same. I had broken the big rule. And I had partied 1 weekend, and I didn't tell anybody. And I just kept going to meetings, and I just kept feeling uncomfortable. So finally, I just grabbed that golden child sponsor in mine. And I was like, "Hey, man, when I went to India, I got high." And he's like, "Dude, I got a bag in my car." So it turned out my sponsor had been smoking pot this whole time and not telling anybody. So out of all the people in AA I could have told to come clean with, I picked the worst guy because me and him were just off and running. I mean, I would say I was going to a meeting, and we'd get high and go to the movies, or we'd get high and go golfing, or we'd get high and go fishing. And my wife thinks I'm in AA, And so yeah, I was out about 7 years. I stayed away from drinking. I just smoked pot for a long time. And then I got a cold, and I started drinking cough medicine. And I had done cough medicine all through high school. That was like my way to get through high school. I had kept it in my locker, and they didn't expel you for drinking cough medicine because they never caught you. But if you came into school drunk, they would expel you. So, and it was a perfect combination of alcohol and drugs. It was a nice, I just really liked it. And so yeah, he takes my pot smoking sponsor takes me to this bar in downtown Cleveland when the flats first started. Jack will know the flats. Hey, Jack. And so we're at this bar, and I got this little bottle of medicinal cough medicine in my pocket. And I'm like, this is dumb. Just give me a rum and coke, you know, because that's really what I want. And it was like I'd never stopped, man. It was like I opened the floodgate and I was right back to it. And I came home and like announced to my wife that I was drinking again. And it just, you know, by now I'd had a couple more kids and I'm growing pot in the basement. And it was a ridiculous situation and just insane. And, you know, it's like my father-in-law, who was a very scary, he was a Golden Glove boxer back in the day, back at Starkweather in Cleveland. And he was a bad dude back in the day. And, you know, but he was like old school. He was like, you know, if Frank wants to come home and have a beer after a long day at work, he should be allowed. And all, of course, my family, they just like welcome me back with open arms. Like, oh, it's so nice to have you back drinking again. We missed you. And so I had all the support. And here's my wife thinking, no, this is a big bad idea. Don't let Frank drink. This is a catastrophe. And then, you know, I got all these AA buddies from the time I was there, and they're like, Frank, you know, come on. And I'm like, no, man, I tried that sober thing once. I didn't like it. And, you know, it had me. My thinking had done a complete reversal, and AA was the last place I wanted to go, you know. And so then things just kept getting worse, and then I'm drinking around the clock, and then I'm physically addicted. And now I'm waking up, you know, after a couple hours and sweating out of my skin and drinking to fall back asleep or pass back out, however you want to phrase it. I'm drinking over the sink in the because I know I'm going to throw up the first one anyways. And I'm drinking the flat warm beer that I passed out with because I knew I was just going to waste it anyways. And I lived like that for a long time. And yeah, then my wife just finally got fed up. One Saturday we got in this big argument and she said, I'm calling the police. And you know, I'm growing all this pot in the basement. And it's obvious, man. When you open that side door, all you smell is marijuana. And I was like, well, I guess I better go because I don't want to, you know, go to prison. So I had a motorcycle and I had a pickup truck and I thought, I'll be smart, I'll take this bicycle and I'll leave on the bicycle. And I'm hammered, man. And the more I ride, the more hammered I get. It's like everything's buzzing through my system. And so I'm gonna go home and change bicycles because the one I was riding had flat tires, and it was just too hard. And I, you know, I'm fucking hammered, and I'm going back to the house, and here's the police car in the driveway, and then I see my wife pointing at me, and telling the police, "There he is, right there." You know, so now I'm on a parade with these police chasing me in their squad cars, and I'm on this bicycle with flat tires, hammered, trying to outrun them. And you know, and they're like, talk, it was a lady cop, and she's talking to me out the window. She's like, Frank, we just want to talk to you. I'm not going to arrest you, and we're concerned for you. And I was like, all right, you promise not to arrest me, and I'll stop. And she said, okay, I promise. And they stopped and they arrested me and took me to jail, and they took my driver's license away. They gave me a DUI and a bicycle because they'd taken the word motor out of the vehicle code. So now it was any vehicle you were on. So now, you know, I tried to be so smart and I still ended up losing my license. And of course, I went to court and I'll never forget, man. I used to like check myself when I was out drinking. Most of the time, I drank at home by myself in my basement workshop. But on the occasion where I'd be out drinking, I would go to the bathroom in the bar. And I would kind of check myself by how I stood at the urinal, you know, if I was swaying, or I could get a gauge on how, you know, if I'd had too much to drink yet, or, and that's how it was at court. And I went to the bathroom at court and I'm swaying in front of the urinal and I'm thinking, oh, fuck, they're gonna know I'm drunk. And so, yeah, I got court ordered back to AA and I came back, you know, this is the last place I wanted to go. That was my thinking. And I was drinking myself to death and I knew it. And A was the last place I wanted to go. That's my disease. My disease wants me dead. It wants me alone. It wants me isolated. And you know, I came back in, and you guys saved me again. And yeah, that was let me see. It was Lakewood Men's Beginners. It was a Monday night, and I went home. And I had tapered off the drinking. It took me a long time. I was drinking like 16 beers a day, plus whatever liquor I had. So I had to taper off. Then I went to 15 beers a day, and then I went to 14 beers a day. There was a, some days I'd go 14 beers for 2 weeks, 14 beers a day for 2 weeks because I just couldn't make the next step, And I finally tapered all the way off, and I was smoking weed just to get out, go, help with the withdrawal. And so I go to this beginner's meeting, and I left there, and I went home, and I flushed all my weed down the toilet because I knew I couldn't. As much as I didn't want to smoke it, as much as I wanted to be sober, if I had it in the house, I was going to smoke it. And I'd proven that over and over and over again. So I finally just had to flush it all down the toilet. And yeah, that was January 10th, 1995. And that began a whole nother journey of getting sober and working through the steps. And it's like the whole God thing. I would speak at speaker meetings, and I would get done, and people would say, "Frank, that was a great story, but you really left God out. You didn't talk much about God." And I just didn't, it wasn't that. I just, fuck, I didn't miss it. I didn't, do it on purpose. I just, it's not a big, that's not something I relied on at the time or believed in. But they just had that message that, Frank, if you just keep coming back, you'll get it someday. Someday you'll be a believer. Someday, if you just keep coming. And it just never came. And I tried. I really did. I tried to be a believer, and I just, there was some of those things I just couldn't get past. I was like, no, that's fucking bullshit. And but AA carried me through all that, just hanging out with the guys. And I was busy, I was active, I made coffee, I was chair, I would secretary, I was treasurer for years. And I had Monday night was my home group, and Thursday night was my home group. So I went to those two meetings religiously. Well, my phone's overheating, sorry. And and then I'd pick up other meetings during the week, and I was always happiest when I went to a lot of meetings. And I eventually did get divorced, and I was a single dad for a while. And I would take the kids to meetings, and I'd take them coloring books, and they'd sit in the back. And they knew all my AA buddies. I can't think of anybody that I'd rather expose them to than people in AA, because I've met some of the coolest, greatest people in the world in AA. And I can't tell you how many times. There's one time in particular, I sat down in a meeting, and this girl came and sat next to me, and she was the only person in the world that could understand what was going on. She knew everybody involved, and she just, it was like, was just uncanny how that worked out. She was there just for me to help me through that whole situation. And I've been through a lot in sobriety. I went through this terrible breakup. After the divorce, I got involved with this girl in sobriety who was sober, and man, she just really taught me how to love, and I really opened up. And that breakup was really, really hard for me. And my dad was buried in the cemetery. He was a life Marine, and so they had this military burial, and I would go to his graveside at night and cry, because there was like nobody I just never I was never a guy to cry on somebody's shoulder, and I would just sit at his grave and cry, and it just like opened the floodgates of years of whatever. I just was never a crier, and it just started coming out uncontrollably. I'd be sitting there sobbing, and then I'd go and work the next day, and then come back the next night and do it all over. And then one day it was done. I got there, and nothing else came out. And yeah, so I went through that whole grieving, whatever, lifelong healing. I don't know. I had a friend that was a Native American, and she kind of adopted our family, and we all got into that, and we did Native American ceremonies and sweat lodges, and so my kids grew up with that in AA. And I've done some processing and sweat lodges, and done, she was a counselor when I first met her, and so she was very professional. as far as, and she was very wise too for her age. And, I don't know, it all just seemed to work, you know. And so that's what we did for a while. And I processed a lot of stuff there. I mean, I tried to do the inner child stuff back in the 80s. You know, I got into CODA and ACOA and SLAA. And I had a sponsor that said, you know, we're gonna do an inner child meditation so you can heal your middle ch your inner child. And you know, I was willing to try anything, you know. So we did, and like he took me back and introduced me to my inner child, and I bailed. I just left. I was like, I can't. I just couldn't handle it. And you know, we were just really unqualified to be doing that kind of stuff. I mean, we were just fucking kids, you know. And so yeah, that's about all the work I've ever done on that. You know, and I had a brain aneurysm in 2009, and you know, they gave me a 10% chance of surviving. It was in the circle of Willis, which is a really dangerous area in the brain. But I heard it pop, and I was just laying in bed watching TV, and I heard this pop in my head, like your neck popping, you know. And then it felt like blood was running down the back of my head. So I reached back, and I was like, "Oh fuck, that's on the inside." And then I broke out in this huge cold sweat, like a colder sweat than I've ever experienced. And I had to run straight to the toilet. Everything was just coming out. And I was like, shit, my body's shutting down. I think I'm having a stroke, you know? So I called 911, and I tell them, and they send out the fire trucks and the ambulance, and I'm sitting in the driveway in a, you know, lounge chair or, you know, lawn chair. And they come up and say, no, you know, you just got a headache. I said, look, man, I've had migraines and headaches. You need to take me to the hospital right fucking now. I mean, and the hospital was only 5 minutes from my house. I was going to drive there, but I was afraid I'd nod out and kill somebody, you know? So here I have to argue with these paramedics that take me to the hospital, and they take me in and scan me, and they're like, fuck, he's got a bleed. He was right. And so they life flight me to another hospital and do the surgery and, you know, save my life. And, you know, there was a lot of recovery to that. I had a lot of left side nerve damage and, you know, but they exposed me to drugs in surgery. They gave me some Dilaudid IV, and the nurse is like, boy, he really likes that. And my kids are like, oh yeah, he hasn't done drugs in a long time. And you know, but I knew my disease was active, and the last thing I ever wanted to do was drink again. And I have a healthy respect for the disease I have, and I do not fuck with it. So I was going to meetings. I had a like a hairnet on my head, because I still had stitches and staples in my head, because I had needed to go to meetings, and I just had to get back to that. I was afraid not to. So yeah, I had to walk with a walker for a long time, and you know, but everything seemed to heal. All right, I seem to be okay so far. I did have an infection come out of it while I was down here in Florida, and I had to go have the first surgery. They cut a big bone hatch in my head, you know, took the bone out, did the, they put some clips on my bleeders and put the bone back in. But while the bone was out, it got exposed to staph in the hospital. So they stuck a staph infected bone back in my head. So then they sent me home like that. And then I got a staph infection, and that almost killed me. And then they took the bone out and put this titanium mesh in because they couldn't reuse the bone again. So then I had this titanium mesh. It turns out that attracts bacteria. So when I was down here in Florida, it swelled up, and so they had to take the titanium mesh out. And the infectious disease doctor down here said, Frank, you know, don't get that mesh again. It just attracts bacteria. And that was MRSA, is what I had that time. And he said, go to Cleveland Clinic and get a plastic. So that's what I did. But I had to wait 7 months to get that. So I had no protection on my skull for 7 months. I had just big gaping crevice in my head where my skull used to be, and I had to wear this stupid helmet, and it was really embarrassing, and it was really dangerous, and you know, it's just scary stuff, you know. But I managed to survive it, and I actually recovered at my ex-wife's house. She took care of me with my daughter. My daughter was living with her, and once I got out of the hospital, I went to her house with her new boyfriend, and they got me back to health, until I came back down to Florida. Yeah, but both my kids are sober. My son's got 14 years now. My daughter just recently got sober 4 years ago after a very traumatic loss of her mother. Her mom got cancer, and it was just this fucking horrible experience we all went through. And I mean, it was fucking horrible watching all that happen. And I had gone back up to Ohio, and was there to be a part of that. But man, it was fucking horrible. Yeah, and so my daughter collapsed at the wake, and we took her to the hospital, and her alcohol level was 0.4. And I was like, boy, that puts me to shame. I think the most I've ever blown was like a 0.24. And she was at 0.4, and she was functioning. She was walking and talking before she fucking collapsed. I was like, oh my God. So yeah, she's down here in Florida. And I came down here after the COVID thing because I'd never met my great grandson, and because of COVID, so I came down here and to catch up with them and to visit my mom. You know, like I said, she's got Alzheimer's, and then my brother had some health issues, so I stuck around and ran his landscape business for a little while until he got back on his feet, and then he had a hip replacement, so I did that again. And now I don't really know what I'm doing other than like trying to help my daughter out down here. I've been fixing her cars, and like today I picked up my great grandson from his daycare center because my granddaughter doesn't drive. But it's like I haven't worked since COVID, and part of me is really ashamed of that, and part of me is like, fuck, it's amazing that you've managed to stay this long without working, you know. So yeah, I'm at a point now where, you know, I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing. I would love to travel. I bought this RV during COVID and fixed it up and drove it down here, and that was a whole big shit show. I had a job lined up in Tennessee, and that's where I was going. And when I got there, the guy had joined that New World Order thing, and so that shit canned that job. So I just like, well, I'm halfway to Florida. I might as well go down to see my daughter. So I drove down here, and I haven't left yet. So I'm parked in my mother's yard, and I have an extension cord and a garden hose. So I'm basically camping in my mom's yard in this camper, me and my dog. And but you know, like I said, I'm here with my granddaughter and my daughter and my great grandson, my mom, and you know, that's a whole nother. Whole nother thing, or alcoholic dementia, but she's not angry, so I'm really grateful for that. I know a lot of people that, well, I've heard a lot of people that got dementia and then just turned into angry people, and she's not like that. She's happy. It's like I took her to the casino because she loves casinos. My stepdad was a big, you know, high roller, and that's something she can do. She can sit at a slot machine and play slot machine, and there's just no long term, so short term's okay. And so you know, it's like I get to see her every day, and she's 85 now, and she's in better shape than I am with all the weird stuff I got going on. I was working in this factory in Ohio, and I got exposed to something that just tore my lungs up. It was this aluminum parts. They made parts for transmissions, and something got in me one day, and it was like drastic change. Night and day was my lungs, my breathing, and I still haven't recovered from that. So I have a shortness of breath issue. I don't know if it's COPD or what. I just went and got all checked out, and my lungs are clear. And I've been a smoker my whole life. You know, I quit when I got to Florida because I couldn't breathe because the air is so thick. So I quit smoking cigarettes, but I started one day. I thought I could go have a cigar, and that would be okay. And now I'm a daily cigar smoker, so well, that didn't work. So that's not helping. Yeah, so I don't know where I'm going. I don't know if I'm gonna get a job down here. I would love to get out west in the motor home and just see the country that I've always wanted to see. You know, the mountains and all that. But now, you know, it's getting to be September, October, you know. I don't want to be driving cross country in snowstorms and fucking bumfuck Kansas or Iowa, you know, Nebraska. But and it's about to get really nice here. You know, I suffered through this terrible hot summer in this fucking oven of a camper. And now I'm looking forward to enjoying the weather down here. I just got my golf clubs already. I'm gonna try to pick up golf a little bit. And I'm an avid fisherman, so I'm gonna do some of that. But as far as face-to-face meetings, I haven't gone to any down here. I was, back in the 80s or 90s, I should say, really, A, wasn't really keen on medication. And, it was like I wasn't really sober because I was on psych meds. But it turned out what was happening, I was getting these full-body adrenaline rushes for no reason. It's like with no emotional. I'd be just driving, and I'd stop at a stop sign, and I'd get this full body adrenaline rush. And I got a motorcycle that does 180, and it doesn't give me that rush. These are just spontaneous full body rushes. So I go to the doctors, and they're like, "Well, we think you have a panic disorder, or maybe it's like a PTSD from your brain aneurysm." So they put me on benzos, some on lorazepam or Ativan. And I was on that for like 3 years. And man, it just wiped my memory. My memory is shit because of that. But, being on that, I didn't feel 100% comfortable with meetings. So I just kind of got out of the habit of going to meetings. That carried with me up until when I went back to Ohio. I still hadn't gotten used to going to meetings. And then I really struggled to do it. But it turned out it was just that MRSA infection going around my brain. That's what was causing all the adrenaline rushes. It had nothing to do with my mind or anything. And it turned out the Ativan and the lorazepam were actually causing a lot of my panic disorder and anxiety symptoms. And it wasn't the full body adrenaline stuff. It was just these panic attacks, and I got real isolated and didn't go out much. And so yeah, I cut down, and I barely went to meetings for a long time, and I isolated severely. I mean, it was just bad. The depression up in Ohio was terrible. Like I said, I went through that whole thing with the ex-wife, cancer, and my kids suffering through all that, and I was just in a really dark, bad place. And I finally started going to some face-to-face meetings and feeling comfortable there. I was able to sit through a whole meeting without, freaking out and getting up and leaving. And then COVID happened. And somebody texted me and said, "Hey, check out the Zoom meeting from your old home group." That home group I got sober at back in 95. I was like, "Oh, it'd be great to see those guys." So I loaded Zoom and went there, and they turned me on to this free thinking meeting that was every day at noon and 9, and I got active there. And one of the first couple meetings I went to on Zoom, this lady was sharing, and I started getting upset with her. I was feeling empathy. And I was like, "Man, this is the real deal. This fucking Zoom thing could really work because I'm feeling this. Even though we're on screens and thousands of miles apart, I'm feeling just like I'm in a meeting with her, And it's not for everybody, but I took the Zoom like fucking a duck to water. I just really loved it here, and I got friends all over the world. And we used to hang out for hours during the pandemic. We'd go to 4 to 5 meetings a week or a day on Zoom. And then we'd hang out all night. I talked to Mark one night, and I watched the sun come up in Ireland, and he watched the sunset in Ohio. And it's just been, and it was just what I needed because I really needed to get my thinking straight. So going to lots of meetings and just bombarding my disease with fucking recovery. And I got my thinking back to that good old AA feeling. And that's what I've been feeling lately. It's just that I've been picking up my meetings a lot lately, and I've been feeling better. And I really think that's something I forget about. It's like the more meetings I go to, the better I feel. And that's the only thing I can pinpoint this latest upswing on. Because I still suffer with depression and low self-esteem and shame. And it's like I'm a prisoner of shame, I just realized that recently. And I've been able to look at a lot of stuff, from my childhood, and maybe stuff I'm still carrying that's hurting me, that's keeping me from going out and getting a job again. But I really have no interest in a career or anything. I've had jobs where I made 6 figures and did really good, and then I was happy mopping floors. I really was, to be honest. I really was happy mopping floors. And I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing. I'm just here and I just keep waiting for the next direction, I guess, or adventure, next chapter of my life. I know my daughter's happy I'm here and helping her and my granddaughter, and I can't say enough about my great grandson. He is just a fucking joy. Here's a good example, one of my theories and things, just totally off topic. My daughter brought her truck over because she needed her brakes done. I'm changing her brakes on the front, and I took the tire off the lug nuts, and they're all sitting on the ground. And I'm, halfway under it doing the brakes, and up comes my great grandson, and he picks up a lug nut and he puts it on the lug. He threads it on. He didn't see me take him off. He just knew that it went on there. And I was like, "Are you seeing this, my daughter?" And I was like, "This is genetic information that got passed on from me to him and from, because I've been mechanical all my life. It was just a gift I just was blessed with. I drove my mom crazy. I was taking apart hair dryers when I was a kid. Just I was always taking shit apart. And that must come from my genetics because, I never like had any training or anything. They did test me one time in Columbus. I was living in Columbus and somehow I got wrapped up in this school bus mechanic job for the state of Ohio. And so they had me take a test before they gave me the job. And he said, "You did better than 80% of the people that took this test." And I'd never been trained in any of that shit. It just always made sense to me. And just to witness that, and I've seen it in animals too, like my dogs. I raise dogs, not professionally. I just like to have puppies. And so I had this brother and sister, actually Huck's dad, my dog's dad, at my old house in the country, and they were hunting this groundhog. And they worked as a team without ever being trained. It's like they instinctively knew how to hunt that groundhog. And they were signaling each other and just the whole pro I watched the whole thing start to finish. And I was like, "That's all genetics, man. That's no training. That's just all genetics. That's in their genes. They have that information." So I'm a big believer in this whole genetic transferring of knowledge or experience because there's lots of things in my life where I felt like I've done it 100 times the first time I did it. I was like, it just my brother let me fly his plane. I was like, "Man, I feel like I've been doing this my whole life. It just came natural." Same thing with motorcycles. It's just, yeah. That's some crazy times on motorcycles. Anyways, yeah, I guess I really needed to talk. I don't know how. So yeah, now I set this phone out here so I know how long I'd talk. Okay, 45 minutes. I've gone way longer than that, let me tell you. I led Avon Lake Friday one time for an hour and a half. And that was an old school traditional AA meeting, and I kept apologizing for it. And it was my second first lead, so I gave my first lead, and then I was gone, and I came back, and these are all the people I got sober with, 7 years prior. They were all still there. They just, they didn't leave and go out and start drinking. They stayed in meetings and got new cars and new houses and better relationships, and I was out destroying my life, and they. I just felt like I needed to apologize to all of them and explain it all. And they're like, "You just had a lot to say, Frank. Don't worry about it." Very understanding. But yeah, I'm so grateful for finding AA and that AA was ever formed. It's amazing that they were able to figure this shit out because I was fucking lost and I couldn't come up with this on my own. It's like I say that at meetings a lot. It's like I would sit home and, I'd go to meetings like discussion meetings. And I'd say, "Man, I don't think about this stuff on my own. It's like I can't sit on the couch at home and think these good, positive recovery thoughts. They just don't come to me. It's not how my brain works. So I need to go lots of meetings and get my head right. And it's almost like a subconscious thing. So effortless. So yeah, I hope I help somebody. And thank Donnie for asking me to lead. It's actually pretty comfortable here tonight, so that worked out well. Thanks everybody. Good to see all my friends. Thank you for coming for the support. And I run a meeting on Sunday, Tusnula, at 1 o'clock Eastern. It's a check-in meeting. It's like the evolution of AA. So please join us if you want. If not, Asiost. Thanks, everybody.